I'm not a woman. Is this all there is? The four children had surely asked them this once or twice as they returned from a long day in the fields to yet another dinner of cornbread and peas. Maybe they no longer asked because New Deal relief meant more provisions, or maybe they no longer asked because the answer didn't change. The family selection specialist described Mrs. Barclay as a thin person of the pine knot variety. Was it her own biology that rendered her a woman reducible to a wounded lump of tree? Was it a life of hard work and sorrow? Was it that she pushed more cornbread and peas onto her children's plates and less onto her own? Is this all there is? She surely asked this of what was left after the tornado tumbled the house, plucked the crops, spun 80 chickens into the sky, and in its desperate aftermath swept her family away from those with whom they had gathered in community. Is this all there is? Surely she asked this when the children died. Perhaps pine knot was just the word for her after all. A tree binds its wounds into a knot when a branch is torn away. Perhaps her body gathered into itself in sorrow when the children died, hardened in its wounds even as her heart wrapped itself around those four living children. Those children the family selection specialist thought cute, well-fed, and well-dressed. Is this all there is? The question surely lingered at the end of each harvest. Another rented farm, another board and batten shack. This time they knew no one. In summer, their tall corn hid from view the largest peach orchard in the world. Now, 1,000 acres of abandoned crab trees that abutted the farm, the rotting fruit permeating the air. Maybe they could sneak a peach or two, maybe even a bushel or so, to can for winter. Hungry winter and surrounded by farmland as far as the eye could see. God knows I must not know how to farm, her husband said. I have been at it all my life, and I still have no more money than I had at first. Is this all there is? Sorrow. Lettered in green on the white wooden cross, 2 feet tall, on the left side of the mantel. Adversity, on an identical cross to the right. Framed in the middle, Joshua Reynolds' Age of Innocence, that classic image of unspoiled childhood, sold everywhere, available nowhere. The dead children whose faces faded from memory remembered through a small girl dressed for a life of ease, softly lit, her unblemished skin blending into the cream of her dress. Is this all there is? Mrs. Barclay, a name but not her given one, a sliver of a story in an archive, the husband and the family selection specialist who interviewed them for resettlement, the main attraction. An unobservant, unreliable narrator. A hint at loss on the mantle. A moment in amber, its beginning untold, its ending unknown. A life of scarcity amidst abundance, a whisper of love amidst sorrow, a trace of hope amidst despair. Is this all there is?
What you've just heard is titled Pine Knot Woman, penned and read by historian Allison Collis Green. We described it as a poem. Allison wasn't so sure, which is likely the point. Whatever we call it, Pine Knot Woman ponders and contests scarcity in the economic and religious history of the American South. Returning to the refrain, is this all there is? It longs reflexively for inarticulable alternatives to an impoverished, gendered archive.
In this episode of Money on the Left, we speak with Allison about her book, No Depression in Heaven, with an eye toward contemporary debates around the Green New Deal. Subtitled The Great Depression, The New Deal, and the Transformation of Religion in the Delta, Allison's book critiques what she calls the myth of the redemptive depression, which particularly in the American rural South, eroded the legacy of the original New Deal by affirming fantasies of self-help and individualism.
Many on the left today see the New Deal framing of contemporary social and ecological politics as a concession to liberal nostalgia. However, No Depression in Heaven reminds us that right-wing and religious dismissals of the New Deal played a key part in rolling back government provisioning under neoliberalism. From our perspective, then, the original New Deal remains a crucial rhetorical battleground for the future of American political economy.
Allison teaches United States religious history at Emory University and researches American religions as they relate to politics, wealth and poverty, race and ethnicity, the environment, and the modern rural South.
Allison Collis-Green, welcome to Money on the Left.
Glad to be here.
Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about your personal and scholarly background, how you became a scholar of religious studies in particular?
Sure, yeah. So the religious studies part came first, and for a long time it was pretty self-centered. My dad was a Southern Baptist minister. This goes way back. He left seminary to return to his home church when I was small, and that was in a rural part of the North Carolina mountains where he and my mom had grown up. I was four, and the church that we went to, like I said, it was a church he'd grown up in. It's kind of the center of our universe. I spent a lot of my childhood climbing the trees in the churchyard, playing hide-and-seek in the pews, or wandering up the road by the church to my grandparents' house. I knew everyone there. I learned later that we were kicked out of our first rental house when the landlord saw that my dad had Greek and Hebrew texts on the shelves. You were just supposed to trust King James and not mess with all that other stuff. And I learned that after another transition, which was when I was 12, this big split in the Southern Baptist Convention that had been ongoing rocked our world, and we had to leave that church. Too much learning and too little preaching, too much love and too little hell was what people said. So my dad found odd jobs after he left the church. He drove a fuel truck for most of my childhood, and he'd figured out what he was doing for a while, and I knew from that moment that I was going to study religion. Christianity was this thing that had held us all together in this community, and then it was the thing that had torn us all apart in this community, and I wanted to understand it. And in a sort of really childish way, I also wanted to know what was so dangerous in those foreign texts that got us kicked out of the house. So when I went to college, I knew I was going to study religion, and I knew I wanted to learn Hebrew Bible, and I thought I wanted to learn Greek, but I fell in love with Hebrew. I took 6 semesters of biblical Hebrew, some anthropology of religion, and Scottish Calvinism on the side. That was my adolescent rebellion. It's like pretty typical, right? Yeah. So when I graduated, I joined Teach for America. I moved to the Arkansas Delta. I thought with my background in Hebrew Bible and not knowing much about the world around me, I thought all the rural places were the same. And so my childhood in the Appalachians would be a perfectly adequate preparation to teach in the rural Deep South. You will be shocked to hear that it wasn't. In my first week in the Delta, the local Churches of God in Christ led a boycott of the segregated public school system where I taught. The schools were segregated because the white kids went to an academy. And I faced new questions about race and class and justice. And for the 2 years I was there, I knew that what I really needed to know and learn was American history. And if I wanted to answer any of the questions that I learned there and some of the ones I'd had all along, that was the route. So I went to grad school to study religion, wanted to learn some history on the side. I started in a religion program. I took 1 semester of history classes, and I was just hooked. The methodologies of history fit the way I think. I began to learn what was wrong with the narratives of history or limited about the narratives of history that I'd grown up with, and started to piece together some of the answers to the questions I had to ask better questions. So I switched programs. And here I am. I'm a historian of religion now.
Great. So I'd like to turn to your book, No Depression in Heaven. In that book, you focus on the Delta region, kind of nestled between Arkansas, Tennessee, and Mississippi, in order to develop a critique of what you call the myth of the redemptive depression. Would you mind fleshing this out for our listeners? What is this myth? Where did it come from? And what are its stakes for you for history and maybe even contemporary American politics?
Yeah, let me start with some of the stakes, and I'm going to move on from personal narrative after this. But I learned a story about my own family only after I'd written the book. So it's not a story about what motivated me, but it's one that helped me see the stakes of the argument that I was making. My great-grandfather, in the 1920s, had 3 children and three school-age sisters, and was left with all of them in his care. In the 20s, when things were supposed to be great, he had to send 2 of his sisters to an orphanage because he couldn't afford to feed them. This orphanage was 4 hours away. He had a job in the Feldspar mines, and it wasn't enough. My great-grandfather thought he could bring his sisters home when things got better, but things did not get better. And one day when his wife, my great-grandmother, was away running an errand with one of her own children, the third child, who hadn't been accepted by the orphanage because she was chronically ill, she fell into the open fireplace in the kitchen and burned to death. So I had written about abuses in orphanages and about the things that happened to families who were, for various reasons, crippled and crushed by the Depression. I didn't know how much of that was part of my own story. Those living sisters lived 4 hours away in that orphanage for the rest of their childhood, never again to live with members of their own family. I knew them distantly. They didn't have much to do with the family for what I think are probably obvious reasons. So I knew about the sisters. I knew something about the orphanage story. I knew nothing about the sister who had died until I'd finished my PhD in history, written this book about religion and the Depression, and my grandfather died, and the family started telling these stories. We had joked all through my childhood about all the moonshining preachers and married cousins in our family tree, but nobody told this story about poverty and suffering and hardship and loss and humiliation. And so I started to think about the way that the stories that we have in our own histories that are full of pain and sorrow and shame often die with the people who carry them instead of becoming part of our lived knowledge. So we learn cleaner, tidier versions of our histories. And so those stories shape our ideas about the world and where we fit in it. And if we don't learn about the suffering in our own pasts, in our own worlds, then I think it can be really hard to see it in others. Or if we see it, we are likelier to blame other people for the suffering that befalls them. So that's a sort of personal story about what I see as the stakes in this myth of the redemptive depression. And I think I'm going to sum it up in a couple ways. One of those ways is when I finished the book, I had a friend on Facebook who posted a meme of, it's like a picture of a grandmother. She looks very Appalachian. She's standing in front of a farm. She's all by herself, which is really important. And it says over it, it says, "Grandma survived the Great Depression because her supply chain was local and she knew how to do stuff." Mm-hmm. Now, this is a claim that you can make that seems so persuasive because it's a version of history that all of us have heard. But it's also a completely fabricated version of history, and it's a completely inaccurate version of history. I mean, the local supply chain was a central problem in the Depression. Knowing how to do stuff doesn't mean a hill of beans when there's no money and there's a drought and you can't even grow a hill of beans. And if you can, you're probably going to feed them to hungry neighbors. So in this kind of framing, in this meme, suffering becomes, especially the suffering of poverty, becomes an individual problem, neither a political problem nor a social problem. So you have one of the richest countries in the history of the world with one of the highest wealth gaps, highest rates of child poverty, homelessness, and incarceration in the world. And we blame the poor, the homeless, and the incarcerated. Or we blame the work the government does to mitigate unnecessary suffering. So we have in this country a long history of blaming poor people for their problems, but that wasn't always the only way we thought. The Great Depression brought such quick and deep suffering that it made visible the costs of capitalism and the systemic causes of poverty. And so Americans sort of united around this idea that a federal response and a federal safety net wasn't just like a pipe dream or a path towards doom. It was a moral imperative, the best and maybe the only way forward in this crisis. So if you want to tear away that safety net that was not completed but begun during the Depression, or if you want to tear down the federal government, none of the things I've just told you is a convenient story. So you have to make up a new story. And I would say that that story goes sort of like this. This is the sort of standard narrative that a lot of us inherit of the Depression. So the greatest generation suffered through the ravages of the Depression, but they came out of it stronger. Maybe Franklin Roosevelt helped them back on their feet with works programs or Social Security, but then they pulled together and they helped one another and they helped themselves. So if you think of it in religious terms, you could say the Great Depression redeemed them. They suffered just enough to turn to God, to realize they could help themselves and help their communities. And then they fought another world war and they won and they built cozy houses and they went to college and they raised families and they went to church or to synagogue every weekend. So the greatest generation in this framing is independent and hardworking and grateful. And then the social programs of the New Deal destroy their descendants, right? The rest of us are just a big disappointment. We're coddled by the government. We're lazier and greedier with each passing generation. Does that sound like a familiar narrative? So that's the narrative that I call the myth of the redemptive depression. That's a story that I'm talking about. It recasts the greatest economic crisis of the 20th century into this sort of morality tale. It's like this purifying experience that brings people together and brought people to God, or it would have done that if Franklin Roosevelt and his big government hadn't gotten in the way. Big government's a problematic term there, but I'll come back to that. The thing about that story, though, is it's a really handy story to sort of erase the suffering and the sorrow of the Depression, all of the things that brought about the New Deal in the first place. It's a story that erases the decades of bipartisan effort that protected Americans from another Great Depression for a long time. It's a story that ignores the way the greatest generation actually rallied together to build a welfare state, which is what enabled them to prosper. But it didn't enable them all to prosper equally. And so it's also a story that emphasizes the experiences of the white middle class, but ignores the network of federal programs that enabled the white middle class to become what it was, like home loans and farm loans and Social Security and the GI Bill. These programs at the expense of people of color, and especially Black Americans, who have historically received far fewer federal benefits than white folks. So I think one of the most toxic elements of this myth of the redemptive depression, as I call it, is the argument that really is an echo or began in the welfare reform debates of the 90s, but now we've just sort of accepted that the New Deal destroyed the work of churches and voluntary associations. Even if you think the New Deal was okay, it destroyed this work. And in so doing, it undermined Americans' inherent compassion in favor of an impersonal and permanent welfare state that rendered the poor helpless and dependent. This is a framing advanced by like Marvin Alasky and a lot of others in the 90s. Paul Ryan said in 2012 in a lecture at Georgetown that rather than a basic entitlement of citizenship, which I would argue it is, the social safety net, in his words, dissolves the common good of society, dishonors the dignity of the human person. So conservatives then frame this as a debate about who should do the helping. It's not a debate about what we do, but who should do it. Why shouldn't churches care for the poor and leave the state out of it? But that's a little, or a lot, disingenuous. No one really believes churches would do what the federal government does or did, and I think that's actually the point. Even now, a lot of private charitable work, a lot, relies on public dollars. Without our taxes, it would be gone. That's where we might disagree, but that's at least how it's funded now. Back in 2018, when the first disastrous Trump budget came under discussion, this anti-hunger organization called Bread for the World estimated that if you were going to make up for in individual church spending what was taken out of the budget, it would cost $714,000 to maintain the existing social programming that budget would cut. So the moral case against the welfare state rests on basically two assumptions. One, that poverty and suffering are the result of individual failures and not flaws in political or economic systems. And second, that there's thus no need for a welfare state to assure a baseline of standard of living for everybody, that in fact that's bad somehow. So the moral problem then is the poor and not the persistence of poverty. And at the end, that is the message of the myth of the redemptive depression.
Hark, here the hearts of men are failing, for these are latter days we know. The Great Depression now is spreading, God's words declared it would be so. I'm going where there's no depression, to the lovely land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble, my home's in heaven, I'm going there.
And so to dig into the specifics of the counter-narrative that you trace to that myth in your book, I'd like to perhaps talk about the history of aid in the Delta as you do from the 19th century up until the Great Depression. What did aid look like in the Delta region leading up to the Depression, and how was it structured, and perhaps also what were its problems?
Yeah, so the first thing you have to do to peel back this myth, right, is look at what things looked like on the ground in this moment. So to do that, you could sort of start anywhere. I'm going to start with the sort of mythic golden age up to and through the 20s, when there was no federal safety net to speak of, and when Americans were supposedly doing really great, when everything was booming. Now, if you want to see that golden age of voluntary aid in its purest form, then you have to look at places where public aid didn't exist. There were parts of the country where municipal and state level aid was fairly expansive. Memphis, Tennessee, and the Mississippi and Arkansas Delta were a place that had very little of either. So Memphis and the Delta, for just a little context, was, and to some degree still is, a single coherent economic region. Memphis was the economic and cultural capital of the Delta. It sits north of the Delta. It was where the cotton market was. It was the mule market for the Delta. And then the Delta is the rich plains, the rich soil and sort of area beyond them that extends for miles down both the Arkansas and Mississippi sides of the river, the Mississippi River. The population of that region in the 30s was more diverse than you'd probably imagine. There were wealthy planters and industrialists. There were poor factory workers and farmers. There were Protestants and Catholics and Jews. There were African Americans and a pretty wide range of immigrants and white folks. And this makes it a pretty interesting case study of how aid operated across institutional lines, how it operated across geographic lines, and how it operated across racial and ethnic lines. And then from the rural outpost to the city center, because it's also going to look very different in the city from the countryside. So before I go on to describe that aid, I have found it useful to have, I do this with my students, and I do this when I talk about the book. I want to ask you to do something. Okay. So imagine this. Let's say it's 1930. You have a little farm in the country, or you have a little shop in the town or the city. You have a family constituted however you want to imagine it. You've always scraped by, but since the stock market crashed, prices have bottomed out, nobody's buying anything. You lost your savings in a bank crash. Your farmer business has gone under. The bank has repossessed your property. Your family's hungry. Your partner has died of tuberculosis. You're sick. Your kids have no food. You have no money. There's no work to be found. So I want you to actually answer this, and I want listeners to think about this. Where do you go for help?
Okay, so let's say I go to my church.
Okay, so great. One of the first places you think to go is to your church. And you might be, depending on who you are, your church might be middle class. Maybe you were once part of the middle class, because churches are divided by class. So you might be able to get a little help from your church. They might feed your family for a week. Now your church is, or say you go to a poor church, they've already helped everybody. Either way, your church has done what they can. Where do you go next?
Neighbors?
Yeah, you go to your neighbors. But man, there's a drought. There's a crisis. Everybody's hungry. You share what you have the best you can, but I mean, the drought doesn't stop at your doorstep. So where do you go now?
Well, I start thinking about stealing things.
Yeah, I mean, one option is to just take. But you got to travel pretty far to find people who even have much to take. Can you think of anywhere else you would go? You're really desperate.
Might move.
You've gone everywhere you can think.
Relocate if you can.
Yeah, right. This is a significant response to this crisis. It's just pick up whatever you have left and you go. You look for a place where things are better. Maybe you find it. Maybe you don't. Everybody else is doing the same thing.
And we can't go back to the church at this point. They haven't replenished their goods yet.
Right. So you might try a different church, right? That's an option. Not all churches are equally resourced. So I'll just sort of go through the options. There are a few more options that you would have had than you've mentioned, but not a ton. So let's say, look first at public options. Now, I asked you to think about if you lived in the Delta. If you lived in the Northeast or in the Midwest, you'd have a few more options. Because there were municipal aid funds and there were state forms of aid. In either case, those resources were still pretty patchwork. Now, if you happen to be a veteran, you might have access to a state pension Now, this would only be the case in the South if you were a Confederate veteran, which was the South's first form of welfare, and clearly a form of welfare for whites only. If you were an abandoned or a widowed mother, wouldn't apply to any of you, you might receive a few dollars of mother's aid, which was essentially a program that social workers advocated for around the turn of the century and in the progressive era, so that widowed or abandoned mothers could care for their children at home instead of turning them over to orphanages. Orphanages in this period weren't just filled with kids without parents, but with kids whose parents simply couldn't take care of them. So the idea was that mother's aid would keep kids out of orphanages so that mothers who could prove that they had been widowed or abandoned and hadn't just been irresponsible and gone and had a kid, because those did not deserve any help, obviously. But if you'd done everything right, and probably you had to be white in most places, then you could get a little bit of help. In the Northeast, it actually might be enough to help you take care of your kid. In the South, mother's aid was mostly for whites, was available only in a few cities, and was just a couple dollars a month in a lot of cases. Now, if you were sick, and you were sick in this scenario, there were charity hospitals at both the state level and private charity hospitals. If, and this was a big if, you could get a bed. And there were hospital beds in Memphis for both black and white patients, but they were not equivalent, and they were not adequate in either case. Now, if you were really destitute, you could also go to the poorhouse, where if you were deemed able and deserving, if you weren't able or deserving, you're out of luck. If you're able and deserving, you could work the poorhouse farm in exchange for very basic accommodations and all of your worldly possessions. So that's sort of it for public aid in much of the United States before the New Deal. Now, on the city level, some cities beyond Memphis offered more. By 1930, 76% of total aid in the nation's largest 116 cities was public. That averaged $1.09 per person per year. Now, in Memphis, my sort of exemplar here of private charity, the total aid averaged 55 cents per person per year, and those proportions are precisely reversed. 76% of total assistance in Memphis was private, and the Delta, it was all private. That was the only option. So I want to tell you a little about now about what that private aid would have looked like. That's the aid that y'all thought of first, the sort of your family, your community, your church. There was a little bit of institutional aid, because between the Civil War and the Great Depression, women's societies and home missions organizations built schools and hospitals and orphanages and settlement houses to reach needy white people in the city, and they always prioritized their own members first. Catholic and Jewish charities were a lot more expansive. They served members of their own communities first, but they also helped a lot of others. By the 20s, a lot of those aid organizations, both in Memphis and kind of around the country, united in consolidated community funds that produced all sorts of brochures explaining, as one in Memphis was titled Where to Send People for Help. And then it had a long list of all the agencies that might help people who were aged or orphaned or hungry. So you could look at these brochures and you could think, wow, I mean, anybody who needs help has somewhere to go. They gave the impression that all you had to do is just ask. But if you look more deeply, you see that those agencies only focused on institutional aid. So you could find a place, there's a real problem with poverty among older folks, but you could find a place to send a really indigent older person if you didn't really care about the conditions there. You could find an orphanage. Each of these agencies made it clear that nobody was entitled to adequate nutrition or a home or to health. In fact, if you had too much of any of those things, it might spoil your will to work. And so the head of Goodwill Industries, which is like the Goodwill we have today, it was a sort of make work and charity organization. The head of Goodwill Industries said, this is a Methodist, said in 1927, the first taste of charity is as dangerous as the first shot of dope. And like, there's a big dope scare at the same time too. So that is that's a real danger there. So this was the way that even the people who are providing charitable aid are thinking about it, right? It is a last resort, and people really have to show they deserve it, because you really don't want to mess with the workforce and their willingness to work at low wages. So for people in the South and in Memphis, this argument doesn't apply equally, of course, to everyone. It applies most strenuously to African Americans, who in Memphis represented 40% of the population, but received even less than they paid into the municipal and charitable coffers. Only 3% of the community fund in Memphis, 3% of the community fund budget went to the blanket category of Negro aid. Black churches and women's societies and fraternal orders were the only source of support for most Black Memphians in need. And if your family just was like chronically poor or hungry, starving even, maybe losing their home, they really didn't have anywhere to turn. In Memphis, only the Salvation Army offered a comprehensive soup kitchen. In the countryside, people relied entirely on informal aid, on their local churches, their families, their communities. And there's this sort of sense that nobody really starved in the Depression, but there are all sorts of state-level nutrition studies that show that, in fact, people were very hungry and were suffering a wide range of diseases of malnutrition, pellagra and rickets and all sorts of horrific diseases of hunger. And that is while things are good. That's before the disaster. So the stock market crash didn't immediately affect Memphis and the Delta, but then you have this record-setting drought in the spring and the summer of 1930. And so the cotton, which is a drought-resistant crop, the cotton is parched in the fields. Food crops shrivel up long before the cotton, and farmers now face a long winter with no food to store, no income for basic staples. And even those who had managed to put by a little bit of money, especially in Memphis and the Delta, saw their savings disappear in a wave of bank failures. For the Delta region, it was a bank in Nashville that collapsed, and most of the banks in the region failed. So if you'd saved, if you'd done everything right, you still lost all your money. You still had nothing. And so that is the start in Memphis and the Delta of what would become known as the Great Depression.
So how much of this is tied in explicitly with the kind of theological doctrine of like, or how it was interpreted as like personal responsibility, individual responsibility, and how much of it can we explain by broader political concerns about the spread of like Bolshevism, socialism, communism, anarchism throughout the 20s?
That's a really good question. I mean, as far as I know, I'm a historian, not a theologian, but I don't have a formal doctrine of personal responsibility. There's an American doctrine of personal responsibility, I would say. I mean, the fear of Bolshevism is part of this, but these attitudes long predate those fears. These attitudes are deeply embedded in American thinking in the 19th century. In part, they come out of Americans' difficulty in managing the transition from a kind of community-based society to a larger one, the sort of, you know, big themes of industrialization and urbanization, and trying to figure out how you live together in a world where you don't know most of the people around you. But this sort of, there's definitely a theological component to this idea. It's part of the messages folks would hear in churches on Sunday. And there's a tension between the social gospel ideas that emerge in the late 19th century, very much out of, if you take Heath Carter's argument, very much out of the ranks of labor, coming only later to the middle class. And if you take Janine Drake's argument, very much reduced in ambition by the middle class. You get this sense that people in the churches have some sort of social responsibility to each other, but that social responsibility, which has to look different in the city from how it looked before, entails in part a responsibility to manage the behavior of people who are not prospering, right? If you do things right in the sort of American narrative, you should prosper. I mean, the 19th century gospel of wealth literally says that poor people deserve what happens to them, and that everyone should be rich, and everyone could be rich if they just did things right. It has a long history. It has deep precedent. What's really striking about the Depression is not the that this legacy persisted, but that it actually faded for a little while, that there was another way of thinking that gained traction, not just among Christian socialists, who also were increasingly numerous in that period, or socialists more generally, but among a wide swath of Americans.
Could you talk a little bit about that new way of thinking and how it evolved? You've done a nice job of giving us an overview of the infrastructure and the kind of rhetorical scaffolding for the shoddy aid in the Delta region. What happened after the Great Depression, and how did that sort of infrastructure and justification evolve?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the Depression is a process, right? It's a sort of a long period. So the initial response to the Depression, you know, the banks crash in 29, nobody really thinks this is going to be more than a little hiccup, or no one who gains a lot of public hearing. So the initial response really isn't very promising. People at the start of the Depression did not know that what they were looking ahead at was the Great Depression. They actually thought things were supposed to get better. And for the first couple of years, most people thought things would just turn around pretty quickly. As with previous recessions, there was this boom and bust cycle, and this was just part of American capitalism, and we had tried to manage it in the progressive era so that you could control the cycle, but this was just a thing that was going to get better with time. A lot of religious leaders said that, you know, this was a good thing because this would kind of purify the country, and people would stop, you know, girls would stop cutting their hair short and smoking cigarettes, and all the, sort of a response to all the, like, the Roaring Twenties kind of stuff, right? We'd get right with God, and then we'd get better. But that didn't happen. You had all this preaching about a spiritual depression, and we just needed a spiritual recovery for an economic recovery, and you didn't get either one. Things kept getting worse. The response among a lot of people wasn't this moralizing or call for evangelism, but just like this kind of stunned agony and silence, this kind of bewilderment about what was happening. And then there were people who had the luxury of sticking their heads in the sand. There's a Methodist bishop in Memphis who wrote on Christmas Day of 1930 an editorial in the Commercial Appeal called "Nobody is Starving in America." And essentially the message of the editorial was, we don't need soup kitchens, we need a moral awakening. Well, 9 days after he writes this editorial, black and white farmers outside the town of England, Arkansas, banded together and marched into the center of town demanding food for their families. So these farmers are starving, and people all around the country are just sort of stunned by this as it reaches the news. They're stunned by the idea that one relief worker said that people could hunger with the bountiful soil immediately underfoot. They had assumed that farmers, as another relief worker said, had only to decapitate another hen or pull up some produce from the garden. But the hens were gone, the gardens were cold and bare. It's winter. By February, more than 500,000 people in Arkansas, a quarter of the state's population, needed help getting food. The one other place you can get help is from the Red Cross if a disaster is declared. And so that's what happens, and the Red Cross begins to provide a limited amount of food aid. What people were marching for was actually for Red Cross food aid, for which had then been denied. So these events changed the way people talked about suffering and charity and individual responsibility. When you have farmers in breadlines, you have breadlines, you have farmers marching for food, then it's really hard to make the same claims about deservingness and about the meaning of poverty that you might have made a couple years before. So private aid organizations had been really proud of all their success in caring for everyone who really needed help, again, very limited in number. But they faced three crises all at once. First, the number of people who wanted help goes through the roof. Second, the donations to charities and churches plummet, and their savings vanish in the same bank failures that crush farmers in the middle class. So more people need help, there's less available, and then finally, the defense that the people to whom this is happening deserve whatever they get completely falls apart in the face of such widespread economic and environmental crisis. So churches and charities tried to help. They didn't just moralize, although they rarely gave up an opportunity to do that. In December of 1929, the Salvation Army in Memphis had served 1,700 meals. The next winter, it served, depending on the month, every single month, it served 5 or 10 times as many meals as that. It eventually drained the swimming pool to make room for homeless men and boys to sleep on pallets on the pool floor. So the Salvation Army is doing all this work, is actually expanding its work, but most agencies are collapsing because they don't have the kind of support that they need. And if voluntary agencies are doing poorly, churches are doing almost as badly or worse. They're struggling just to stay open and a lot closed. Between 1929 and 1932, this applies to churches, this applies to voluntary agencies, national income dropped by more than 50%. 50%. So for another couple years, church giving holds steady relative to national income. But that still means a 50% loss at the very moment that demands on the resources of voluntary agencies and churches are increasing. And the churches immediately went into self-preservation mode. They cut benevolent spending, as they called it, first. The president of the Southern Baptist Convention, which had had a series of crises in the 20s, said in 1931, "We are putting off the Lord's cause while we try to settle with our other creditors." So they weren't like, they were pretty direct about what was happening. When the money ran out, the churches turned their spending inward instead of outward. So denominations are scrambling to keep the programs they value, but they're cutting corners. So we talked about orphanages before, and so I'll use orphanages as an example. Like I said, orphanages housed non-orphans, and in the Depression, they're housing a growing number of non-orphans, kids whose parents just couldn't take care of them, couldn't feed them enough. And even before the Depression, these orphanages were often really inadequate and dangerous places. There was a growing recognition that institutional care was not the appropriate setting for children. The institutions persisted nonetheless, and in Memphis, an orphanage called the Industrial Settlement Home, it was a church-supported African-American orphanage in the city of Memphis. In August of 1929, this orphanage burned to the ground. And the matron assures the responding firemen that everyone is out of the orphanage, and she was wrong. So 8 young boys from ages 2 to 6 died huddled together in a second floor bathroom of the orphanage. The report that followed showed that the boys hadn't died of the fire or of smoke inhalation, but essentially died in a room that became an oven in the heat of the fire. It also revealed that the home had been declared a fire hazard long before, that it was so overcrowded, children regularly slept in the closets and in bathrooms, and that the matron regularly beat children with shoes and hot fireplace pokers, and in fact, the fire had been set by a girl whom she had just beaten. This might have been a particularly dramatic, but wasn't the only episode of abuse like this. Similar episodes rocked the white Mississippi Baptist orphanage in Jackson in 1929 and 30. This is right at the start of the Depression. A grand jury actually indicted the superintendent for administering excessive corporal punishment. And let me tell you, to get indicted for administering excessive corporal punishment in Mississippi in 1930, it has to be pretty excessive. In one case, the superintendent beat a 14-year-old girl with a board, stopping only when the board broke, and discovered only because this girl wasn't an orphan. Her aunt visited and discovered that she was just a mass of bruises from her shoulders to her knees. So she shares this with the churches, with the orphanage. She makes a stink about it. And immediately the denomination blamed the children. They were too unruly. They had brought this on themselves. And then only later, with the outcry of parents and others in the church, did it remove this administrator. So the Depression, it leaves people so hungry now that parents have to choose between letting their children starve and leaving them in orphanages that are rife in many cases with abuse and violence. Not all were, but how could you know? And then between 1929 and 1931, private aid collapsed completely. Overstuffed orphanages now turned kids away to starve. Religious leaders saw what they could ignore in the 20s and what Paul Ryan and what he said and his colleagues ignore today, that poverty exacts a price, a terrible price on families and communities. There's no dignity of the human person, as Ryan put it, when that person lies dying alone of hunger or the diseases of malnutrition and exposure, or when that person can't keep her children warm or safe, or when that person has to abandon his own siblings so they don't starve. So the church has had to reckon with this. They had to look at this and they had to figure out what to do with it. They could have, religious leaders could only turn their heads away for so long. And some had been looking for a moment when they could speak up. So as they looked at the suffering before them and their own inability to do anything about it, religious leaders across the nation actually stopped using the language of individual responsibility almost entirely. They also stopped using the language of charity in large degree. Even Southern Baptists started to write about the failures of capitalism in state Baptist papers in Mississippi and about Americans' basic responsibilities to each other. There's this renewed sense of the public and of public responsibility and of our common fate. They called for the federal government to step in to protect its citizens. So Americans in the churches, outside the churches, had started to conclude that a welfare state, as we would come to know it, would not destroy human dignity. It would recognize and preserve human dignity. Now, the actual response came much more slowly, but this was a pretty significant shift in language and in understanding.
Well, if you strike a thorn or rose, keep a going. And if it hails or if it snows, keep a going. Ain't no use to sit and whine, 'cause the fish ain't on your line. Bait your hook and keep it trying. Keep it going. When the weather kills your crop, keep it going. Why, it takes work to reach the top. Keep it going. If your skies look dark and gray, tell the world you'll be okay. And don't forget to pray. Keep it going. Well, now, welding's going.
Yeah, the response we'd like to know about, and especially sort of how federal action is being framed and interpreted locally and through the lens of religious community.
All right. That we can do. So, like I said, federal response came slowly. The demands increase. Herbert Hoover is really committed to voluntary aid, and he's genuine about it. He thinks this is the way that you address problems, that if the power of the government bends itself to these problems, it'll create a bigger disaster than the one he's already in the middle of. He also, I don't think, ever quite got his head around the scale of this disaster. He had worked for the Red Cross. He was deeply committed to this idea of voluntary aid. But in January of 1932, Hoover's administration made a move to provide emergency loans to banks and to corporations, and then later to states and municipalities for public works projects. But a lot of states and municipalities didn't take these because they're loans and they knew they couldn't pay them back. It was all too little, too late. So Roosevelt trounced Hoover in the 1932 election on the promise that he would leverage the federal government to end the Depression. And the model there would be some of the programs that he had first tested out as the governor of New York. And when I say he trounced Hoover, I mean, it's almost unimaginable in 21st century terms. Now, you have to take into account the limited electorate and the voter restrictions in the South. But Roosevelt won 57% of the popular vote and 88.9% of the electoral vote. So he won handily. The barrage of legislation that he signed in 33 and what would become known as the first 100 days included an agency that would be especially important to the church's conceptualization of what they did, and that's the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, or FERA, which was the first program to put federal funds not just towards employment relief, but also towards direct aid to people who were suffering, with the caveat that this aid would be administered in whatever way that people at the city and state level, administrators at the city and state level, decided was appropriate. And in practice, that most often meant food aid and jobs aid. Now, significantly, FERA prohibited explicit racial discrimination. Not surprisingly, local administrators figured out and proved remarkably skilled at finding proxies for racial exclusion. So even though racial equity to some degree was written into it, it was also written out of it in practice. So federal aid outpaced that of private agencies by a magnitude that's sort of hard to even comprehend, because of course it could leverage so many more resources across the nation, but especially in places like Memphis and the Delta that hadn't offered much in aid to the poor. New Deal spending made everything else just look like pocket change. So at the peak of private giving in 1931, Memphians raised 88 cents per person in aid, 75% of it private. 3 years later, by 1934, with the New Deal in full swing, Memphians received $7.21 per capita in aid for direct and work relief, and only 12 cents of that was private. So that's a really dramatic change in who's spending money and how it's being used and how much of it there is. So in just 5 years, as federal dollars provided the work and food that Memphians needed, private aid dropped from 3/4 of relief spending in the city to less than 2%. In the Delta, almost all aid was public. So you could look at this and say, oh, well, look, I mean, you can see here that the state swept in to take over the church's work. They did this, and the churches just, they were crowded out. But by 1933, the limited aid that churches had offered before the Depression was already long gone. This wasn't the state replacing what churches were doing. This was the churches collapsing and the state then stepping in at the request and demand, in many cases, of the leaders of those churches and agencies. And I think even more significantly, New Deal programs shifted the emphasis from individual suffering to collective responsibility. So it's no longer about your particular suffering. It's about our shared responsibility to each other. This is also a shift from private charity to public welfare, this ideal that the Depression justified and that the New Deal reinforced. And so you ask what religious leaders had to say about it. Well, I'll talk first about what they said in the region and then a little bit about what people said nationally. Now, you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear that liberal Protestants applauded Farah, as well as the National Recovery Administration, which for the first time acknowledged workers' rights to organize labor unions. Liberal Protestants saw both programs as a realization of the social creed of the churches, a statement that the Federal Council of Churches published in 1908. Catholics linked New Deal programs to papal decrees regarding social justice and workers' rights, and Jews pointed to the connections between the New Deal and the teaching of ancient Israel's prophets. So you have a pretty unanimous and vocal range of support for the New Deal across the country, including in this region. Maybe more surprisingly, conservative Protestants were just as enthusiastic. A lot of them said Roosevelt drew his inspiration straight from the Bible. There's a Southern Methodist who wrote, the blue eagle is now perched on my door. This was the symbol of the National Recovery Administration. I've signed up for the war against the Depression, he said. And the National Bible Press actually tracked the biblical allusions in Roosevelt's sermons and would publish those. And if you saw complaints about the New Deal from the clergy in the years after the first New Deal, most of those complaints were that the New Deal didn't do enough, right? Christian socialists were particularly unhappy with it. So Farah and the other 1933 programs curbed the crisis, but they didn't establish a permanent welfare state. That would come later. In fact, those came in part as a response to those demands when Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act in 1935, making sort of what we know as Social Security. There were also provisions for the orphaned and the disabled. And then the Works Progress Administration, at the same time, eventually created public works jobs for 8.5 million Americans. Upon the passage of those two programs, this is a remarkable resource. Roosevelt actually wrote a letter to clergy that was supposed to go to every clergy person in the country, asking them to describe the conditions in their area, and then also to say what they thought about the Social Security Act and the WPA in particular, and then the Second New Deal in general. And over 30,000 clergy responded by the end. And the letters, I've read them, they're kind of astonishingly enthusiastic. Now, the New Deal liked to catalog everything. So the first 12,000 replies that came in within the first couple months, administrators actually tallied them as by how positive they were towards the New Deal, and a full 84% were either entirely or largely in approval of the New Deal and its programs. Clergy wrote over and over and over that the welfare state was in their understanding a religious achievement, not an encroachment on their work. that it freed them to focus on supplementary care or to return to a focus on evangelism. And you really see this across the theological spectrum. Of course, there were those who disagreed. There are premillennialists who see Roosevelt as one of many possible antichrists. There are the elite white Southerners, and primarily, although not exclusively elites, who worried that the New Deal would undermine Jim Crow capitalism, which was pretty remarkable because they had kind of gained an iron grip on it to ensure that it wouldn't do that. And then you have Christian and Jewish socialists who wanted a president who would unmake American capitalism, not revive it. And that's, in the end, what Roosevelt was trying to do. So their frustration is that the New Deal is shoring up the system that they that for the socialists needs to fall. So there's a range of concern. It's pretty quiet to start. And then there's a sort of slow simmer of concern that the federal government, in taking over the responsibility for caring for people, was in some way weakening church's moral authority, weakening the church's hold on Americans by strengthening secular institutions, but not religious ones, which also weren't in the works programs. Religious churches weren't rebuilt in the same way that like community centers were. But that's kind of it. I mean, that's the dissent in those early years wasn't happening in the churches. It was happening in the ranks of business.
Thanks for that. Reading your book from the perspective of modern monetary theory, especially in the spirit that we approach it in this podcast, couldn't help but notice a few meaningful threads sticking out that we'd like you to thematize and consider. One that struck us was how conservative fantasies of independence often affirm and even avowedly embrace this sort of false sense of scarcity that I think you really thematize in the poem that that you read for us, often to shore up Jim Crow racism, or, you know, even in the sense that you were mentioning with this so-called theory of crowding out between church and state. I think that's central to the way modern monetary theory thematizes this false sense of scarcity. And I was wondering if you could perhaps ponder those questions and that those linkages for us, and perhaps see in the ways in which these ongoing tensions between church and state inform the way we can think about our relationship to one another in America today.
Yeah, I really like this question. I haven't thought maybe in precisely that language before. But I think that works. If you think about the grandma meme that I talked about earlier, that she knew how to do stuff and her supply chain was local, that's a grandma who doesn't need anybody. It's an image where she's on this big farm all by herself. And, you know, one of the key realizations of the Great Depression was that people need one another, and that we need one another not only as members of our particular community or communities, but as members of a broader public. When we rally together, when we look at ourselves as members of a broader public, then we ensure our collective health and our well-being. We can build good, diverse, and inclusive communities and schools, and ensure jobs with a living wage for those who want them. Although I do have reservations about the emphasis on work, because it has echoes of those ideas about deservingness. And but still, you can accomplish these things. And Americans did this. That's how they thought, and that's what they did in the midst of this devastating economic crisis. And it's something we could do again if we wanted to, if we had that sort of shared initiative and sense of collective abundance that somehow marked the response to the Depression. But we have this sort of zero-sum language of scarcity, and I agree with you that it's false. We are a mind-bogglingly wealthy country. Our kids don't have to starve. Our kids, and if we believe in the sort of sense of the collective, these are all our kids. They don't have to be ripped from their parents. They don't have to be thrown in cages to starve. They don't have to be shot down in the street. And the language of abundance doesn't create competition in the way the language of scarcity does. If there's enough for everyone, then the very wealthy, the people who hold the levers of power, we'll have a much harder time pitting the poor against each other. And if you can't pit the poor against each other, then the poor might band together. This fear that the poor will band together goes back all the way to Reconstruction. It goes back further, but take Reconstruction. White elites saw these fragile and incomplete and messy and problematic and really fraught alliances, but alliances nonetheless, between poor black and white Southerners, especially among farmers. They saw interracial labor unions, the Knights of Labor, the populists, all of them imperfect in lots of ways, but terrifying to the white elite power structure. So you get men like Ben Tillman, who rose to the South Carolina governorship on the promise of doing lots of great things for poor white people, and the threat that black men were just violent rapists. This is an intentional effort to fracture these alliances across lines of race, within lines of class, and it worked. People fell for it. White people fell for it. Poor whites chose race over class, and it happens over and over and over. And as long as that works, as long as your gain is my loss, then we'll be exactly where we are. And as long as your gain is my loss, as long as we think in those terms, we preserve white supremacy, we preserve elite economic power, we preserve the systems that separate us from each other. If we think in terms of abundance, if we think in terms of what we can all do together and who we all are together, then we're starting from a very different frame. And those powers, the powers of white supremacy and of sort of elite economics, which are deeply bound together, they start to lose power. And the church and state is part of this sort of same milieu. This is this sort of idea that the church and state is zero sum. It's like the same sort of set of ideas. And so I think the implications are enormous, right, for thinking in terms of abundance as opposed to scarcity.
For a lot of people on the left, they're excited about the Green New Deal, right, reviving the name and the legacy of the New Deal project, and especially since really it's taking off. On the other hand, I think people who are, you know, not just left of center, but really left, are wary of that framing for a number of reasons, many of which we've outlined here already. And so it feels a little bit like a kind of concessionary move to kind of, you know, get tap into a certain kind of like white liberal nostalgia or something. But, you know, talking to you and reading your work, it just becomes so clear to me that the legacy and the memory of the New Deal is actually key semiotic terrain for American political identity, both past and future. And I think it's your project is so important for us to think about, you know, what this Green New Deal framing is doing, and not just more broadly in the larger American political landscape, but then even more specifically in the South, and what the South, not that the South is some homogenous block, but what the South's living memory of the New Deal is, and what does the Green New Deal potentially sound like in the South? And yeah, what are your thoughts on that? What are the limits? What are the problems that need to be overcome? Are there certain problems that are not going to be overcome anytime soon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, the this is such a historian's answer, but for me, the best way to answer this question is to sort of step back and look at the ways in which the New Deal reinforced and in some ways codified white supremacy, but also the ways that it enabled new kinds of responses to it. So the New Deal consensus, of course, thrived for decades. Republicans and Democrats both expanded the welfare state on into the 60s, and in response to civil rights activists, in part, who protested the unequal benefits that the welfare state provided to whites. You got Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, many of which, when people think of the welfare state and talk about the New Deal, the programs they're talking about didn't exist in the New Deal, like Medicare and Medicaid and like the way we think about food stamps and food aid. Those are more recent innovations. And Johnson's administration imperfectly, but it responded with war on poverty programs that were designed to expand provisions for health and child welfare, this time across explicitly across racial and ethnic lines. And so this was a really, this was to that point the most equitable expansion of the welfare state. And so when you talk about the New Deal, you also have to talk about the Great Society, which is a sort of connected part of its legacy. It operated very differently. It operated very often through voluntary and private agencies as opposed to primarily through public agencies. It also operated in an era when you had a couple decades of backlash. And you can't separate that backlash from this sort of idea of scarcity and the idea that as long as white people lose any sort of hold on economic power, then everything's going to fall apart and nobody, white people at least are no longer going to have anything. You know, frankly, they're thinking in terms of non-white people doing what white people had been doing. So the war on poverty, sort of with this rhetoric of scarcity, became what is often and aptly called the war on the poor, this idea, again, to blame the poor for their own suffering. And then you get all these efforts to shrink and privatize the welfare state and also simultaneously to expand its punitive powers so that there's a lot more emphasis on policing and a lot less emphasis on aid. And like Elizabeth Hinton has written beautifully about this. And this erases the efforts of the state to close gaps between rich and poor, between black and white, between new immigrants and established citizens, between women and men. We now have this new period of vast income inequality that is unmatched even by the 20s. And what I'm saying is all of this work to dismantle the welfare state rests on this myth of the redemptive depression. And that's a myth that infuses a sort of contemporary faith in the voluntary and the private sectors and skepticism about the federal government. So this retelling does this sort of erasure that I've talked about before. And because it's a misrepresentation of our history, it also represents a misunderstanding of our present. And I think that there are kind of two pieces of things we should know about the New Deal, things we should remember about the New Deal, that without setting aside all of the ways that it replicated existing Jim Crow and white supremacist structures, in fact, we should kind of double down in focusing on those, I would argue, in order not to replicate them yet again, in order to do better. There are a couple of lessons to sort of take away from the New Deal. One of which is there's a long and storied history of the religious, specifically the Christian left, the political Christian left, if you want to describe it as such, to separate it from the theological left. But this isn't just a story of the left. The story of the New Deal is in part of a consensus across a wide range of Americans that we are in some way part of a collective, that we are responsible for each other, and that what you have doesn't mean I don't. And so I think that's one lesson to take away, is there are many ways that American religious and faith traditions have conceptualized their place in society. And the one that we have right now is far different from the one that we had for most of the 20th century. And there's no reason that it need persist. And I guess second, the real shortcoming of the New Deal was its work to bolster white supremacy. And so the last lesson is that there is all this language about racial solidarity and class solidarity, and white people cannot choose class solidarity over racial solidarity. It's not a choice. If you want to see yourself as in solidarity with working people, then you can not only think of yourself as in solidarity with white working people. People of color, especially Black Americans, have reason to be suspicious of the intentions, even of well-meaning whites, because over and over and over, white supremacy has broken these interracial alliances. So the New Deal's great flaw was its concession to even its occasional embrace of white supremacy. And so I would say, as white activists, we have to step back, we have to listen to people of color, we have to carry through with our commitments, and stop picking white people first. It's a rather abrupt ending, but that's
that's good.
I ran out of words.
Well, thank you so much, Allison Collis-Green, for joining us on Money on the Left.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for hanging out for a while.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
That was so good.
Yeah, thank you.